On our walk from Free League's office, when we had just like met them and said, oh, we want to do this, I think we posted the image on our Instagram and Facebook and everything, like, oh, there's going to be a Kickstarter. And I remember thinking, like, what the fuck have we done? Like, we can't do this. Back then, I was very pessimistic about my expectations for this, because we had never done anything like it before. That was very, very scary to actually go live and say, oh, we're going to do a Kickstarter, because then you have sort of promised to do something and you have to commit and you have to like follow through with it. So I was kind of blown away by the support, and it like made me want to do more stuff and draw more stuff and publish more adventures and, you know, and just work with the community and be a part of it. And that's been like a drug since the first day that I realized that there were people who wanted to play this. Like, I want to just, you know, be a part of the community that they are building around it.
You're listening to the Lost Bay podcast, a show about and with indie tabletop RPG designers and artists. Today, my guests are Johan Noor and Pelle Nielsen, designers of the pitch black apocalyptic fantasy tabletop RPG, Morkborg. And speaking of Morkborg, on the Lost Bay Studio store, pre-orders are open for the Wicked Wanderers Winter Bundle. You're looking for a pack of cool zines and supplement to get through the winter or the summer, depending on where you are? The bundle is here for you to provide endless hours of group or solo play, zines, adventures, maps, NPC and class cards, even a full mini solo game. The bundle is 15% off retail price. Pre-orders are open until December 1st. 15 items designed by 6 international designers are included in the bundle. So don't wait, head to thelostbaystudio.com and grab yourself a great bundle at a very cool price. Back to the show now. If you're into indie RPGs, you've probably heard about Morkborg. It's unique, both by its looks and its content. The game has a rolls-light system and comes with a set of amazing tables and a unique Doom mechanic, and we'll talk about that later. The game fantasy setting features a dying world where all is dark and doomy and gloomy, even the characters you play. The book itself has a unique visual style, wild and colorful. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google it right now. I mean, it's mind-blowing. So let me introduce today's guests, Johan Noor, layout designer and artist, and Pelle Nielsen, writer. Both are Swedish.
So we're in Sweden. We're in two different locations. So I am in a smaller, but not small, but smaller town called Norrköping, which is like 2 hours from Stockholm, where Pelle is right now.
That was Johan, layout designer and artist.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in Stockholm.
And that was Pelle, writer of the book.
How were you when you were teens? Were you like into imaginary worlds or fantasy or into RPG at all? How were you when you were teens? Like, who wants to go first?
I go first, Johan.
Yeah, you were a teen before me.
Yes. I was a teen back in the 80s, in the mid-80s, and I was quite into fantasy stuff. I was reading a lot of fantasy books, like, of course, Tolkien and stuff like that. And I started to play role-playing games maybe 1985 or something like that. It was very boring in Sweden back then. And when the role-playing games came into our culture, it was a big thing for lots of 10-year-old kids.
Were you in Stockholm at the time or in a smaller town? Or?
I was in a smaller town back then. I was living in the south part of Sweden in a city called Lund. It's not a small town. It's quite big for being Sweden, but it's a lot smaller compared to Stockholm.
Okay. And Johan, what about you?
So I was always a nerdy kid as well. But like, I kind of combined, like, we were a lot into like skateboarding, and I was kind of getting into like hip hop and punk rock, that sort of scene. But at the same time, we also played like our version of Dungeons and Dragons, which is Drakar och Demoner. And of course, the post-apocalyptic game Mutant. Those were the two big games in a way in Sweden back then. This was not in the 80s because I was like born in the 80s, but I started playing role-playing games when I was, I think, 11 or 12. And I kept at it until, I don't know, maybe when I was in like my 20s or something, when other things were more fun and more interesting, and I took a break like everyone and then got back to it after a while.
Yeah, that's the same story for me. I started playing when I was 10, 11 years old. Then I had a break for 15 years or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Or more.
That's long. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, maybe it was 20 years. I started again when I was 36 or 37, like that.
I think role-playing games have always been like a creative exercise in a way, a creative hobby for me. So kind of like you, Pelle, I think I've always been like creating stuff and writing my own adventures and role-playing games, like ever since the start, really.
And what brought you back to RPG?
I think something happens in lots of people's life when you come to a certain age. And not only role-playing games came back to me, also the music, which I was listening to back when I was 17, 18 years old. I was listening to a lot of death metal and black metal, like bands like Dark Throne from Norway and stuff like that. And then I quit listening to them, and there was indie pop and stuff like that going on for 10 years. And then I slowly came back to my roots, so to speak, and started to listen to that kind of music again. And I still do.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to me, I guess. Like you're going back and forth, and then eventually as you grow up, you sort of realize like, oh no, this is what I really like. Like something that I've always had in the back of my mind in a way. I don't know. It's part of growing up, I guess.
Yeah, probably. And it's fun, like you're both talking about going back to some moment in your personal history and some moments like in the cultural history, like going back to some music, for example, as Pelle said, because one of the questions I wrote is that I feel that there's a very strong late 80s, early 90s vibe in Morkborg, actually. It's super contemporary, but at the same time, I feel like just sent back in time. I don't know, both visually, in terms of vibes, in terms of energy. I don't know, does that make sense at all to you? Or
yeah, I think definitely it has sort of that energy in a way, for sure. I mean, it's not nostalgic, but I think it has that sort of unapologetic energy that a lot of pop cultural things had in the 80s and 90s. Like, it doesn't take itself very seriously and it goes all in. And of course, it references a lot of the music that were really strong back then, you know, a lot of metal and punk rock and stuff like that. So,
and so how did you meet? How did that happen?
Do you want to go, Pelle, or should I?
It started out that I was writing a horror game. As of now, it's only in Swedish and lots of people have heard about it anyway. It's called Barkhexan. It's a horror game, folklore, forest kind of thing, a little bit black metal horror somehow. But yeah, I was posting some texts on Facebook and Johan got back to me and said that he wanted to make illustrations for this.
Yeah, this was the first time that we talked also.
Yeah, we did that book and also published that book.
And I think we kind of realized working together with Barkhexan that we did that very well. Like, we liked working together and we had the same sort of work ethics and you know,
what's that, the work ethic? What are you talking about?
I mean, like, we're not very prestigious and we work very fast, both of us. We move very fast from like idea to a finished thing. Like, we don't sit there and polish it too much.
You have the same energy.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, but it's not like sloppy energy, moving fast. We're quite perfectionists,
yes.
Both of us, I think. It's very hard for me to accept a mistake. I feel very bad if I find a mistake in a book that I have written.
Yeah. If we find something and like there has been like printing errors, we try to fix it and send people fixed versions of it. So we take great pride in the work that we do.
After publishing this first horror RPG, Pelle and Johan started working on Morkborg, which was originally Pelle's project.
I had this rule system that's the basic, the framework of Morkborg, very minimalistic framework, yeah. Written on one paper. You had some few monsters and the basic rules and some equipment tables and stuff like that.
And you posted in that Facebook group that you had previously posted about Barkexan, and you said, oh, I want to do something about this project, you know, and perhaps do something like a punk scene type aesthetic. And so I again reached out to you and said, oh, hey, I want to work with you again. Like, I can help you with this.
Yeah. We wanted to make a scene, very old school scene, and going crazy and not care about, you know, rules and stuff like that. Just wanted to make something cool.
Okay. So at the beginning of the project, there's the aesthetic and maybe also like the setting or and the lore, I guess.
That actually came later. I think there was a setting hinted at in the classes and the items already. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until we had like some of the book laid out and illustrated that we were like, yeah, maybe we should write about the setting here and add something about that.
About the same time. All right, maybe some few weeks before the Kickstarter for the book.
Yeah, actually.
It was.
It's like, shouldn't we have a setting here? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Really. That's quite amazing, actually, because when I speak with people who play, run your game in the scene, one of the things they love is the setting. Not only the texts, the introduction of the book, but also the way the setting lives throughout the whole game, like in the tables, etc. But
I think that's one of the reasons why it sort of permeates the whole game, because the setting was originally just hinted at in all the tables. Like, it was already like hidden in the text. So we didn't start with just one big block of lore description and then leave it to that. But it's always been, you know, it's been bleeding this setting and this tone the whole time. Sometime during this process, we also came with the idea that maybe we should just end this whole setting. Like, that should be the one of the themes, to just destroy it in game. And that's how the calendar of Necrobel came to be.
Yeah.
So.
And can I ask you how, like, each one of you, maybe Pelle, if you want to answer first, how do you work? Meaning, how do you write? I mean, what's your routine, if you have one?
When I try to sit down and write stuff, it normally doesn't work very well. Stuff comes into my head when I least expect it. Like when I'm on the subway back from with the kids, going home from school, or in the grocery store, or in the showers, other strange places. I come up with ideas and then I start to put it together in my head first.
Yeah.
And when I have quite a clear picture in my head, I write it down. And then I write very fast. So I have a basic idea in my head before I start writing. It's the same if I make an adventure or a dungeon or something like that. Maybe all the rooms are ready in my head and I know how they are connected and how the things work in that dungeon.
I understand now why you write fast, because you start writing in your head before.
I don't have a notebook in my pocket or something like that. I write on the computer.
Okay.
I'm not sitting in the forest with a notebook and write.
Meditating in a dark and scary forest.
I actually realized now that you were talking that we have the exact same process, like you with writing, me with like illustration and design, because that's exactly how I do it as well. Like, I just make the work in my head for quite a long time and then sit down and just hammer it out on the computer. So I think maybe that's why we worked so well together, because once we got started and actually like putting it down onto paper, it went really fast.
By the way, speaking about illustrations and layout, Johan, you said you were like into skateboarding and the musical scene. Were you like producing like visual elements at that time? Like, were you like...
Not really. I think I wished that I were back then. I think I did some few like flyers for poetry slams and stuff like that. And I dabbled with graffiti, but nothing serious. But I think I was always inspired by that sort of visual world. And maybe that was like one of the, for me, nostalgic elements of working with Mercbori, because I could return to that to that thing and actually do it.
One of the visual signatures of the book, or at least something that strikes me, it's the yellow and pink. I don't know, like the black comes as like a natural choice for this kind of setting, but I was even the red, but I was wondering, neon yellow and neon rose, where do they come from? It's great. I love it, actually.
There's been a few people who's asked about that, and some mainly on Reddit have been like critiquing, like, oh, how can this be?
Oh, no.
How can this be like a doom metal or a black metal game with all the pink and the yellows? And I think that's kind of the point. We break a lot of expectations and a lot of rules. And the first thing that would come to mind when designing something like this and this sort of dark and gloomy world would be, as you say, black and white, perhaps, or blood red or whatever. But by taking these obnoxiously loud colors and quite happy colors, because it's like neon pink and yellow, it creates a sort of dissonance to what you are expecting. And I think it creates something new and more interesting. Plus, it's also like very inspired by, like I said, punk rock. And,
yeah,
you know, those kind of colors are, I think, maybe more traditionally connected, I think, in a way, to that sort of music. It creates a fun, mismatched thing where like, you have this sort of super dark and gloomy world and extremely happy-ish colors. There's a lot of humor in it, and that's very important for both of us, to keep it not serious, and there's a lot of gallows humor in it. Yeah, I mean, it's just good if you're reading the book and you're having a few laughs as you're reading it.
Yeah,
because of how miserable and how like over the top miserable everything is.
So you start like sending back and forth texts and images, and when do you say, okay, we've got something here, we need to kickstart it, there's a game, it's cool, let's put it out in the world? So is it something like you knew from the start that you were going to publish a book, or was it something you discovered as you went?
We wanted to publish something. We didn't talk about a hardback book.
No.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was more like a punkish,
like a staple.
Metal scene. Yeah. Yeah, staple scene or something like that. But then we contacted Free League Publishing when we had written 60 or 70% or something like that, maybe. Yeah. And after a while, they agreed to publish the book for us. But I think they wanted to try it out somehow. And with the Kickstarter, we wanted to do a Kickstarter as well. But I think they wanted to check if it was...
if there was interest to it, yeah.
Gonna work, if there's any interest for this at all.
I think the reason that we got in touch with Free League, first of all, because I knew them from having freelanced for them a bit, doing maps for some of their games and stuff. But also, they had a history of helping indie designers in Sweden to like publish their games. Like they had a sub-label for that and had put out a few games, I think only in Swedish though. But then that label was sort of put on ice for some reason. But we knew that they were not like strangers to that idea. So we reached out and said, oh, maybe you can, you know, start doing this again.
This was the first time Johan and Pelle actually met in person. Until then, they had always worked online.
On our walk from Free League's office, when we had just like met them and said, oh, we want to do this, I think we posted the image on our Instagram and Facebook and everything, like, oh, there's going to be a Kickstarter. And I remember thinking, like, the fuck have we done? Like, we can't do this. Back then, I was very pessimistic about my expectations for this because we had never done anything like it before. So I was kind of blown away by the support, but that was very, very scary to actually go live and say, oh, we're going to do a Kickstarter, because then you have sort of promised to do something and you have to commit and you have to like follow through with it.
I was a bit more optimistic, but anyway, I was blown away by the support.
And what happens at that point? Like when you see that community is responding so strongly?
For me, at least, it was only extremely inspiring. And it like made me want to do more stuff and draw more stuff and publish more adventures and, you know, and just work with the community and be a part of it. And that's been like a drug since the first day that I realized that there were people who wanted to play this. Like, I want to just, you know, be a part of the community that they are building around it.
So yeah, in which language did you write the book?
First, it was written in Swedish, 100% Swedish. We translated it into English. I think it was you, Johan. You translated it into as good English as you could manage. And then we sent it
to Patrick Stewart,
so that he could edit it.
He kind of rewrote a lot of things as well.
Yeah.
We gave him pretty free hands. So the two language editions are quite different in a lot of ways. Like they have their own tone
Yeah, what's the difference in the tones? That's super interesting. What's the shift?
The Swedish flavor is a bit more harsh.
Yeah.
Maybe not as many words. It's a bit colder and quite short sentences and harsh. And Patrick Stewart was editing and making his more, it was more flavorful. And yeah.
But he has a very special tone as well. That comes
yeah
to.
That's super interesting. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, because you were speaking about differences in tone between like the Swedish version and the English version, I was wondering, is there a Swedish way, like, I'm speaking about like contemporary RPGs, right, without going back like to the 80s or whatever, to write and or to play like RPGs too.
That's a fascinating thought, and I think there is. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes, yeah. I think, I mean, obviously it goes back to the 80s, because we never had Dungeons and Dragons growing up. Like, that's not the base of our RPG culture here. So like, we had our own games, and I think, I mean, it has to form the way that we play, because for the longest time we never really had like levels as a thing.
No.
And we didn't have this thing where you like get experience for killing monsters. You have to correct me if I'm wrong here, Pelle, but I don't think that was a thing.
But that's right. If you manage to use a skill, you have a possibility to
increase it, yeah.
Maybe get better in that skill after the adventure, but you don't get more hit points. Your abilities don't get better. It's only your skills. You might get better. And it was not levels, as you mentioned.
And I think it was focusing on going into dangerous places and like getting treasures. It was more about helping or like solving problems for people. Or like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. In my head, when I compare it, I kind of envision the Swedish role, the games traditionally, to be a bit more open world rather than being inside dungeons.
And what were the games that like laid the foundation of RPG in Sweden that were like the iconic titles of the 80s that were played instead of Dungeons and Dragons?
I think of three games. So the first one is the fantasy game Drakar og Demoner that we mentioned. It's mm-hmm. called Dragon Day now. Kind of vanilla fantasy-esque thing. And then there was Mutant, which is a post-apocalyptic thing with a lot of humor and like anthropomorphic animals as well. But and then it was the horror game Cult as well.
Cult, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a couple of games in between that it's called Hawk,
yeah.
Chill. And then Sagan om Ringen, that's Lord of the Rings game that was translated into Swedish, but they were not as big as Drakar og Demoner Mutant.
No.
The Drakar og Demoner first game was out in 1982 and Mutant 2 years later,
84,
in 84.
Yeah.
And by the way, people were playing Cult in France. I didn't, because also I was living not in mainland France, but in a small island. It was complicated to find games. But yeah, I know that people were playing Cult. I don't know if it was like an official translation of...
I think there was, I recall that there was a French translation of it. And that was also, funnily enough, that was the game that sort of ended the golden age of Swedish role-playing games, because that got games banned from toy stores.
You've got like your own version of Satanic Panic, kind like of, everybody. Yeah. Or
so we have like previously you could buy role playing games in every like major toy store, and it made it huge. Mm-hmm. But then that kind of stopped because the stores realized what the hell this game was. And like, no way, we're not having these games here. And I think even the Pope condemned it and said like this game is bad. So
like, wait,
yes,
it condemned specifically. Cult, like you mean?
Yes,
that's fantastic.
Yes,
that's a great achievement.
They're quite happy with that, the publishers of that game.
Yeah, I bet they are. Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
So the Morkborg setting is a dying world. Each day in the game, a misery from the calendar of Necrobel can be triggered. Miseries are written like prophecies, and the calendar itself, instead of being like a huge classical spreadsheet table, looks like a religious text, like a Bible, with one column text blocks and entry divided in psalms.
It's such a great tool because it looks like a religious text, and as an RPG, text at the same time. And that's an amazing feature. I mean, both the way it's written, laid out, structured, everything takes so much from those different kinds of literature, like which are kind of literally at the opposites from one another. And that's a fantastic synthesis.
There's a fun like origin story. We had a setting written down and it was already quite dark and doomy. And I think I remember I was driving my kid to like swim class and I was listening in my car to a pod documentary about Nostradamus and the prophecies there. And that got me inspired. Like maybe we should have some sort of prophecy, like a doomsday prophecy. And because they read some of the prophecies that he had done, and they were quite metal as they were, like as they were murdered. Yeah, and we actually have a few of them unedited, like taken directly from Nostradamus in the Calendar of Necrobel. Like I think the first one is directly from his and a few others. And I was like, yeah, maybe this could be literally what's going on. And we talked about it. We both liked the idea. And it took a while for us to pen down the exact like mechanic of it, where you like choose the die type and if you roll a one. But I don't remember where we got the idea to make it like a Bible page. I think that was just something that came to us like, oh, hang on, Bibles are formatted this way. Like they're actually like numbers on each verse. And yeah, maybe you could do it like that. But that was a very nice moment to like realize that, oh, we can make a Bible page and it'll actually work. It'll say both the setting and also the rules.
Yeah, that's such great game design, actually. So I feel like there's a lot of history, like a lot of interest, curiosity for history behind the game, behind the text, although, I mean, it's quite different from our human history, but do you folks or do you play, like, read history? Do you do you take inspiration from historical figures? Or?
Yes, okay. Quite a lot. First and foremost, I very easily get overwhelmed when I get a setting book that is like 200 or 300 pages long and you have to remember all the details and stuff like that. So I wanted to do quite the opposite, to make a short page count on the setting, but that would spark your imagination. That was a design goal. Lots of question marks and not too many answers so that you could start create your own world out of the content. Like you can write a book out of 3 sentences, kind of design goal. But it was lots of history going on in the setting, like old Baroque kings back in the medieval times of the Nordic part, Germany, Swedish kind of kings, like Fatmo the Ninth, that is a bit of a psychopath. And of course, in the north part, there's Antalya. That's my kind of Elizabeth Bathory, the blood countess, the first vampire, or whatever they call her.
How do you live like this interest for history? Like, do you read a lot?
Yeah, I was reading a lot of history when I was a kid, and I was reading history at the university as well. It was called History of Ideas. It's a mix of philosophy and history kind of courses. So that was important. And I was very inspired by Père Lachaise in Paris.
The Père Lachaise is a gigantic historical cemetery in Paris, France, with a Gothic architecture where countless poets and artists are buried, from Oscar Wilde to Jim Morrison and more.
I've been to that cemetery 2 or 3 times and visiting Jim Morrison and stuff like that, and Edith Piaf. But there were quite a lot of very important people and milestones and places that was mandatory for me to include in the setting.
I understand.
And when I was done with that, the setting was, you know, full. I could, so it was not that complicated. Yeah.
That's super interesting. Thanks for sharing all those details about like your design and writing process. So one thing that is absolutely mind-blowing on the Morgborg website is all the gaming accessories that are available, like generators. How do you work on that part? Which is, I think, so important to like the Morgborg universe.
I agree. And I think that's also probably one of the reasons why people are playing and making stuff for the game, because there's a lot of tools for it. And most of the things on the website are made by the community, like the Morgborg cult stuff. And that's something that we always intended to have for free download, because we're both believers in that, you know, free game material will lead to people playing it more easily, and that will just spread the word. And games are ultimately made for you to play. So if we can facilitate that, that's good, you know. But I think the generators specifically, they're important because the book had, since its beginning, many generators in it to let the game master also be improvising and be surprised at the table and not know all the answers. But I think with like having digital generators is that you can expand them almost infinitely. Like, you're not constrained to an A5 page. You can have billions of results if you can manage to write that, and but also have more of like nested results, so you can get very, very detailed, flavorful results. We worked together with Carl Druid, who is the code wizard who did all those generators, because we don't know how to. I don't know how he does it. When we made them, we sort of copied the tables from the book text into a giant like Excel document where we just sat and expanded them and just added a bunch of stuff.
Oh, that's so good. Okay.
So there's a giant Excel sheet for each of these generators. And then we gave that to Carl, basically, together with the graphic design that we had done for the page. And
when I was done with the dungeon Excel, that was huge. It was big spread.
Yeah.
Wait, huge. How huge? We want numbers.
Like, you need to have some problems with your head. Yeah. If you,
I don't care. I can take it.
Yes.
Let's see if I can find the document. I'm actually sitting here with it now. I don't know how to say it, but there's hundreds of lines with a bunch of different columns. So there's one, who dwells here now? One of the many results are like wickheads/goblins/trolls/cultists/escape prisoners running from foreboding darkness. Like, that something running from foreboding darkness can be either of these things. So like, not all the results, but a lot of them have these sort of
subtables.
Like, yeah. Because we wanted to avoid you getting the similar result. We wanted it to feel endless in a way. But also, like, everything kind of had to make sense, because that's a big problem, I think, with a lot of generators, that they are too random. So the thing you get doesn't feel cohesive.
Yeah. And not too gonzo.
Not too gonzo. Yeah, exactly. Not
too gonzo. That was important as well.
But then we send these things to Carl, and by some dark magics, he managed to make a functioning generator out of it.
Yeah. That's great.
That's a design goal as well, and that's also why the core book is quite small.
Yeah.
Is that you can bring it with you without any problems and go to the pub and create a character in 2 minutes, or if you use the generator, in 1 second, and you can start playing an adventure without any preparations with the dungeon generator and stuff like that. I'm very proud about that, actually. That was exactly what I wanted.
And also, since we released the whole game for free recently, there's an artless version for free download on the website. And even before we released that, you could very much play the game without buying it, because we had the character generator, the dungeon generator, the monster generator, lots of free like adventures and stuff. Yeah, I think like accessibility has been very important from the start, to just like make the threshold as low as possible for you to start playing this game.
Yeah. By the way, I've checked the text-only version. It's beautiful too.
Thank you.
Like, for a text only version, you know, I was expecting something, I don't know, not cool, as it happens very often, you know.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful. It could be a book itself, honestly.
Now we're thinking of doing that, maybe. I mean, who knows?
Maybe we have to make an even more boring version of it, because it looks too good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And listen, speaking about layout and the overall design, the book has, not sure if I'm picking the right word, but almost like some kind of Baroque style. And at the same time, like, I feel that it's super structured, like its layout, it's wild, but at the same time, looks like behind it, there's like very solid like layout structure.
I think I tried, but I really couldn't do a book that was too wild because I'm a traditionally schooled graphic designer. And even though this was an attempt to break a lot of rules, I think I kept a lot of the more basic ones, you know, with like typographic hierarchy and disposition, like layout on the page, information hierarchies, and also like readability. I think, I mean, we get, and rightfully so, a lot of criticism for it being hard to read. I would say that most, not all, but most of the text blocks and like the paragraphs aren't that crazy. Like the fonts are actually very readable, but it's a lot of other stuff going on the page that gives this sort of wild and sort of deranged look. Every spread is unique. Every page is unique. That makes it in a way easier to find stuff because as you're flipping through, you're like, oh, I need to know what hit points is. And it's the one, the page with a huge heart in it. Okay.
Yeah.
And there must have been like huge font sourcing work, yeah. I guess.
I mean, I'm a big typography nerd. So on my spare time, I will look at, you know, the typeface pages and Foundry's websites just to see if there's anything new released. So this was a good opportunity to use.
You already had your like collection?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, a lot of these I already had. But to go back to the design, I think the book is structured into different sections. Like you have the setting in the beginning, and then you have like character creation and rules, and then you have optional rules, and then you have monsters, and then you have the adventure. Like those are the building blocks of the book in a way. And the first part of the book, the wild part, that's meant for your inspiration, and that's meant to be read away from the gaming table. You're not supposed to ever flip through that part when you're playing. Only supposed to use the very last pages, either the adventure or the end pages. That's all you need to have at the table. Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant. And what's next for Mirkborg? What are you preparing? Things we should know? Are you preparing things you can tell us or you can't tell us?
Do you have anything, Pelle?
We have lots of things going on as we always. As
yes, always.
But we have a core book. We have two scenes. We have done a vinyl record. There's a GM screen. So the next thing, I think, will be another format.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. Scene.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure this will create a lot of expectations among the listeners. It certainly did right now to me. I think when we hang up, I'll start like thinking about what that could be, honestly.
It could be nothing.
It could be nothing. Yeah, exactly. Just disappointment in a box.
But now the idea is in my brain, you know, it's not going to leave me.
We can also mention like the things that we do, but not the pair of us. Like we have the spin-off game. We have like Cyborg, which is like a separate thing in a way. I'm working on another project at the moment that you aren't involved with that much, Pelle. That's also like connected to Mirkborg. So like there's stuff bubbling and happening, but we've always been collaborating with people and we try to keep doing that.
That's fun. We also sometime, every now and then, we think about the first book.
Yes.
The horror book we did together. Would be cool to have it in English. Sometimes we talk about that as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see.
Time will tell.
What happens.
That was Pelle Nielsen and Johan Noor, designers of the pitch black apocalyptic fantasy tabletop RPG, Mirkborg. As usual, I'll put in the show notes links to the Mirkborg website. It's as beautiful as the book, and there's lots of free stuff in there to start playing the game. And if you want to get yourself a beautiful pack of Mirkborg zines and supplements, head to thelastbaystudio.com and grab the Wicked Wanderers Winter Bundle. It's 15% off. Pre-orders are open until the 1st of December. It's a great deal. All you need to get through the winter or the summer, depending on where you are. You've just listened to the Lost Bay podcast, a show about and with indie tabletop RPG creators. It's produced and edited by me, Iko. Supervising editor is Laura Elle. Music is by Avery Isles. Be sure to give the show a follow in your podcasting applications right now to be notified of future releases, or subscribe to the Lost Bay Studio newsletter. You'll find the link at thelostbaystudio.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well.